be a gain in the forward antenna direction. You could have intentionally fed some signals into the passive antenna and nulled out that front-to-back ratio. Ain't that fun? Are you seeing the power you got once you start using phased array electronic steering technique? K2KEY, QRIW.
I got one comment, Dave. Let me see you quickly.
We'll get to you in a second. Now, Mel first, go ahead.
W2EL, repeater, system.
Okay, let me just turn it to Andy. I know he's waiting patiently. Maybe he has something that he has to say. Go ahead, Andy. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I got to get ready to work tomorrow. I got to find out. I've been listening, and it's a lot of good questions come up, but I'll save them. One thing I just want to mention, if you guys are unaware of this, the company Stepper, or Step IR, STEPPIR antennas, they make that motorized antenna that electrically adjusts the length of the Yagi elements accordingly, as you know, to adjust it for all the bands. One of the features that antenna has, and I don't remember the model number, is that you can instantly switch that antenna's directivity from front to back in an instant with a switch. It's designed so the reflector becomes the driven element. No, I didn't say not. The driven element's in the middle. The reflector becomes a director, and the director becomes a reflector. In other words, I don't have the design in front of you, but you can rotate the antenna 180 degrees. It's like turning it on the rotor 180 degrees in an instant electronically, and that's the way it's designed. That's a big plus. So if you have a station you want to work, and your beam's facing west, you just flip the switch, and now your beam's facing east in an instant. Dick, back to you.
I'm familiar with that phenomena of the Stepper antenna. And you go to K9, Lima, November, Zulu, I think it is. Anyhow, there's a guy in Illinois who's got an array of six Stepper antennas on 180 feet of power, and he has the ability to do that. You get a little bit of degraded performance when you fire it in the reverse direction versus the forward direction, but still that's a handy phenomenon. And you're moving those Stepper motors for the reflector and director, and I think in roughly 5 seconds, it'll tune from a forward beam to a reverse beam, whereas to reverse the whole antenna would take you 30 seconds. So you can tune in 5 seconds instead of 30 seconds by moving the whole antenna 180 degrees. And his great big rotator probably takes 2 minutes to rotate 180 degrees. That's just 30 seconds. So that's a handy phenomenon. But see, Mel, if you had fed a little bit of signal to the so-called passive Yagi, you could have tuned that front-to-back ratio. And that's not obvious, but I guarantee you have that capability. K2KEY, KQRIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, one other observation. You know, when I put the system together, basically I got very involved with 6 meters, trying to work in DX. There was quite a bit of DX on 6 meters at one time. And, was able to even get WAF. And so I was going to see if I could get DXCC on 6, but certain circumstances, you know, became intolerable on 6 meters running high power on it and the whole business, and too much local flack, as they say. I finally had to curtail it and gave up on it. But I was very interested, basically, in what the antennas were doing. I always had that interest, really, you know, in antennas like you, and I never got, you know, to be able to do the experiments as much as you have, you know, had the availability, you know, to do a lot of things. I was just basically shooting blind most of the time or whatever I could read. But I noticed one thing, and I never did get a concise answer on this. Stacking the antennas was great up to what I think was like up to a 30 degree radiation slope. But it seems like anything from 30 up was almost like a null. And it couldn't work. Many times I was in New Jersey, probably hear them, everything like that. Yes, you put up a little vertical and all you were able to do it, no problem at all. Does this stacking arrangement basically create a null pattern, possibly above 30 degrees, such a horizon tick over?
Depending on how the stacking is done, absolutely. But when it comes to vertical stacking, the expert in the United States on that right now is Dave O'Lean, K1WHS. He has a Rode 55 tower, which I think is 150 foot tall, on top of the mountain that's in his backyard. He has an array of 6, 7, 8 Yagis vertically stacked along that whole 2 meter Yagis, all stacked along that 150 foot of Rhone 55, all fed as a phased array, all aimed from Maine down the coast. And boy, that antenna works like a charm. That thing is a blowtorch. But you gotta be careful. As you vertically stack more and more antennas, semi-sections, and properly feed them, your vertical beamwidth is becoming very narrow. If you made a slight error in the phasing harness so that the upper antennas are fed delayed in phase compared to the lower antennas, you will be electronically steering the beam above the horizon, and you might be steering a null on the horizon. Very easy to happen. As you go to higher and higher vertical stacking, you've got to be more and more careful with knowing the group delay velocity, your velocity factor of your cables, and your length of distances between the antennas. You got to make that all come out right. So you got to be very careful, and if you're with a minor error, you can steer a null on the horizon. Lots and lots of guys have done it now. The fact that you ran into it doesn't mean that vertical stacking doesn't work. It probably means there was an error in the way it was done. And to go the next step, it would be a lot of fun to be able to electronically shift the phase between the various elements of the electronic of the vertical stack of Yagi. Now you can steer the beam in elevation. And when you can steer that beam in elevation, and you can aim right at that sporadic E-cloud, or right at that meteor that you're now emphasizing, boy, that would be a lot of fun. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, what I recall quite well, according to time, talking to Telerik, and they did have a couple of people there that really seemed to know antennas. I could say they had a lot of contracts, Telerik, you know, with the government to provide a number of antenna systems. And one of the statements that I have it here as, quote, the stacking arrangement that we provide is the only one that will give you a good gain advantage. Otherwise, you will most likely will not get more if you're lucky enough to get between 1 to 3 dB, depending on that particular method of stacking. Is that really a... In other words, if you didn't buy their stacking arrangement kit system like that, that the best I would have do on my particular system using that BLU system is no more than a advantage of maybe 1 to 3 dB. Does that sound right, Dick? Over.
No, it does not. It may have been sort of true in that day for the techniques that people were using then, and there were a lot of things that people were doing then that later we found out have had some errors to it. People used to believe, for instance, that if you tapered the elements of a Yagi in order to get more beamwidth, bandwidth, that you would be sacrificing gain. Absolutely not true. And they used to think that when you chose the right length of the parasitic element and the right spacing between the parasitic elements, that if you built a longer Yagi, just use the exact same length and the exact same spacing and add more elements. Not true. They would think that when you add more elements, the antenna runs out of steam. Well, if you use those concepts, yes, it runs out of steam. But if you use the right concepts, the antenna does not run out of steam. Dave O'Lean, K1WHS, Director of Systems, makes a Yagi antenna with 102 elements to it. And all those elements are cranking. They're all cooking. So, the bottom line is that the military people have discovered that when you do it correctly, every time you have the right stacking distance and you double the number of elements, and you feed them correctly, you get close to 3 decibels more gain every time you double the number of elements. There is no exception to that rule. And people have built phased array antennas with thousands of elements. And properly done, those thousands of elements give you the predicted gain. So what Telrec said from their experience back in, we'll say, 1960, ain't true today. Don't let that that negativism turn you off, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Dick, this is Tassie. You know, they also offered additional stacking systems, the stacking 3 and 4. Never, of course, did I ever enter my mind at the time to consider that. And I remember that I got a sheet on it. When going to stacking the 3rd or the 4th Yagi, it will, no doubt, enhance the performance. But the stacks must be very high. Of course, you got to adjust your complex system to fit this particular situation. But they emphasize that you must, in other words, you can't stack below what you have now. You have to stack it higher. In other words, push the whole word up. Is that still a factor? Over.
No, it is not.
Now,
there's a law of diminishing returns here. If you've got a single Yagi at a particular altitude and you're happy with it, you stack another Yagi above that, the right stacking distance, you're going to get increased performance. Stack a second, a third Yagi below that at the right stacking distance, you're going to get increased performance, but not quite as much. And here's why. Take that first Yagi, make believe it's on one of those taser-type devices, a sort of an elevator, where you can walk it up and down the tower. As you start off with the Yagi into the horizon near ground level, you're picking up a certain amount of signal. And as you walk that Yagi higher and higher in altitude, it picks up more and more signal. So therefore, if you stack vertically upward, you get more performance more rapidly than when you stack downward. Because the downward stacking antennas, because they're below the tree line level, below the level of the building, and the water towers and everything else in your neighborhood, they're picking up a smaller amount of signal. So therefore, in the reception mode, they're going to pick up less signal and not give you as much benefit as you could get if you were stacking upward. Doesn't mean you don't get benefit, you don't get as much benefit. And if you want to get the maximum benefit, here's something that's really crazy. If you knew ahead of time that the lower antenna is going to pick up 1 dB less signal than the upper antenna, and if you readjust the amplitude of your phasing harness so that in the transmit mode you feed 1 dB less signal to the lower antenna than the upper antenna, that combination gives you a higher gain than if you feed both of them the same. You have to match the environment. If the lower antenna, because of its location, being closer to the ground and closer to the tree line, picks up less signal, when transmitting you should give it less signal. When receiving, you should expect less signal from it and adjust the phasing harness accordingly. That will maximize the gain when you do that. Opposite to common sense, but it's good physics and conservation of energy when you figure out what's going on. K2KEY, K2LAW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. All right, one more thing. This is funny, and I don't know whether or not any experiments have been done with this. One of the great advantages that Telrec said, they had a patent, I believe, on it at the time, that they had this, the boom had a hole right through it, and they had the sleeve, that's where the, you know, the short, well, sleeves are only, I don't know, a couple of foot each side, and that's where the attached, you know, the extension element to it. But they said the big advantage that they had, really, on their antennas, which supposedly was one of their patents at the time, was that they heliarch, they welded that sleeve right through the boom. In other words, the elements that are directly connected to the boom are heliarch, welded. Was that really, is that a factor, or is that just was hype stick over?
Oh, no, that's a real factor. The first evidence I had of it was that in 1969, when I was just getting into 432. The state-of-the-art in antennas was the Ed Tilton 13-element Yagi. A buddy of mine had four of those Ed Tilton Yagis up on his tower for a couple of years. The Ed Tilton Yagi used 8-inch diameter welding rods that went straight through the boom. A hole drilled in the boom, the element went through the boom, and I think the capturing mechanism was a screw that went from the top of the boom and pressed down onto the element. However, what I discovered is that of the four Yagis that I acquired from this buddy of mine, the four 13-element Ed Tilton Yagis, I just had a sudden suspicion that I saw a lot of aluminum oxide. These things have been out in the air, up in the tower for a couple of years. I went down the string with my ohm meter, and I found out that every other element, so to speak, of the director string no longer made contact with the boom. Aluminum oxide had built up between the two, and they were now insulated from the boom. And I knew that they, in the very beginning, when the aluminum was nice and fresh, the boom was making contact to the left and the right side of the element, right where it touched the boom, and that gave the element a certain electrical length. When the elements developed the aluminum oxide and broke contact with the boom, each of the elements now became a longer length. And what I discovered when I measured the pattern of these individual Yagis, mechanically they were all identical. When I measured their patterns, they were not identical. When I measured their standing wave ratio, they were not identical. Because various elements were making and breaking contact with the boom, and they were being tuned to different frequencies. One of the Yagis had a front-to-back ratio that was about 3 dB because of this detuning effect. Many of the directors had become reflectors. It was at that instant of time that I suddenly said, aha, I'm going to build insulated Yagis. And from then on, from 1972 on, all of my Yagis, the elements were either sitting in plastic box blocks held down with pop rivets on top of the boom or with shoulder bushings. They were insulated from the boom by going through the boom, but the elements were now insulated from the boom from now on. When it comes to a low-gain, low-Q Yagi with three elements, you don't have to worry about this. But beyond four or five elements, I strongly recommend you insulate the elements from the boom in some way so that as aluminum oxide builds up, you don't get this detuning effect. One brute force approach to this problem is to heliarc the elements to the boom. Expensive, elaborate, difficult. A much more elegant approach, in my opinion, is simply give up, stop fighting it, insulate the elements from the boom, you get full performance, and the performance stays there forever. K2KEY, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Very good. I was really curious, you know, that it was really hooked into that particular situation, and Telerex was well known for even on a number of their beams, like their ones for 10, 15, 20 meters, of going through the boom with their elements. So I guess that was something of a selling point for them, especially, like I say, they had quite a number of military contracts to provide antennas at that time. A great deal of HF antennas, of course, because there was the backbone of the military at that time. Okay, I think it's getting late, so I don't want to hold this up too much longer because I know Paul wants us to give a little talk on what's going on in space, but I can pick this up maybe a little later with you, Dick. Back to you, over.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We're losing track of time. By the way, earlier, Andy, the A2CDO, was talking about G3SDK, which is mentioned in the January 2008 issue of QST Magazine, World Over 50 Megs. Ian White has a beautiful website. You can find his website by going to QRZ.com. With QRZ.com, you find the Gulf 3 Sierra Echo Kilowatt, Ian White, and on the QRZ.com page, it gives you his email, his website address, and the website address has a lot of good technical information. Another good website that has good technical information is the one by Tom Williams, WA1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org. And another one is the Roadrunners Microwave Group, K5 RMG, K5 Romeo Mike Golf, Roadrunners Microwave Group in Texas. Their website has got some beautiful technical information. All righty. Paul, I hope we haven't put you to sleep. And what's the latest in space? Are you sucking up all this yagging and stacking information? And you're going to start stacking more antennas out there in Ponkonkoma? WS2N, K2RW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Now, I'm still thinking about Mel's 40 meter vertical dipole. That'll be the next one, the one that's supported from the trees. No, not the Yagi. Sounds good. I got one Yagi up there. That's the one I rotate around here on 2 meters, but we'll stick with that one for now, Dick. The space program. Well, the Atlantis, of course, was scrubbed this month because of the sensor. We talked about that last week. In the hydrogen tank, they need 4 sensors to work to allow that to take off. Actually, they could take off with 3, but they went down to 2 that one. That's it. They scrubbed the whole mission. They've got to figure out what the problem is. It's an age-old problem. They've been doing it for a couple of years now. I'm just surprised they haven't ironed this whole thing out yet. The sensors shut down the hydrogen fuel in case there's a major problem. It'll shut the pumps off, close the valves, that's it. And then, of course, they would go to an abort setup. They'd either come back to Kennedy, or if they were too high and far away, they would go to one of the other landing sites in Spain or Morocco. The mission now for Atlantis is now scheduled for January. January 10th will be the earliest date for STS-122. But it's a great mission. It's got this gigantic lab on board built by the European Space Agency called Columbus. Big, heavy, round cylinder, living quarters. You can put 4 or 5 people in there comfortably walking around, sure, sleep environment. Will be attached to the International Space Station. In particular, it's in a Harmony mode, Harmony node. The Harmony node was installed last flight. That in itself is a large spherical thing, six sides on it, to not only attach to the discovery part of the lab, the discovery lab, which is part of the International Space Station, but also all these connections coming out of these 5 remaining connections connected to other, a number of different components, one of which is going to be the Columbus module, another living quarter going to really, make the cubic feet inside the International Space Station very big. They've got these 10 gigantic rack assemblies inside to hold scientific experiments. Each rack is as big as a refrigerator, so you can imagine putting 10 refrigerators inside of a room, how big this thing might be. So the mission will go up the first 3 days of a 12-day mission. Usually are similar to previous missions. They'll go up with the 50-foot boom with the 50-foot extension on it, making 100 feet, and inspect the outside of the spacecraft, make sure everything's okay, and eventually they will dock with the space station, and they'll unload the Columbus with the Canadian arm boom stowed on board with 2 spacewalkers bumping this out, connecting it to the Harmony node. Got Walheim and Schneigel, they'll do all 3 spacewalks. The next day they'll be attached. They'll be able to enter it, look around, poke around, but it's not until the eighth day of the mission that they'll do another spacewalk, go outside, connect everything. Connect the ammonia lines, the cooling, connect the electrical lines, the power, connect data lines for the data transfer. All these things have to be done. Every time a module is installed, bypass lines to go to the docking port for the shuttle. Now they have that capability with so many solar panels up there. The space shuttle goes up, and normally, let's say, a 10 or 12-day mission, they can extend it to 3, 4, 5 days because they can pick off power from the International Space Station from these gigantic solar arrays where they have essentially jumping cables going from the space station out. So every time they connect up another module on, they have to extend those cables to do it. It's a big deal to do that. It's just not plugging things in, unplugging things. There's all kinds of fancy connectors. It's a big deal to do a project like that. So separate spacewalks just to connect all the connections that go on the outside. It's interesting about the International Space Station. A lot of connections are made on the outside of the space station with a Mir space station by the Russians. A lot of connections were done on the inside. That's why when you saw the inside, it looked like crowded with all kinds of garbage all over everywhere. It looked like it was a tough place to live. The space station that we have now is roomy inside. A lot of mechanical connections are done actually on the outside of the spacecraft throughout the whole International Space Station. So that should be pretty good. And there'll be another spacewalk later on. What they'll do is there is a broken gyro on board the space station. They have four of them. They're going to disconnect, put another one on. They're going to remove a gyro and put another one in place unrelated to the Columbus laboratory. And just a couple of other important missions. One thing I like that NASA does is they have these extended missions for everything. They had a Galileo for orbiting Jupiter. They extended that thing many, many times. So instead of a couple of year mission, it turns out to be like a five year or a 10 year mission. They've already done that with Cassini, and they'll probably keep doing it with Cassini. Of course, the rover's on board Mars. Sphere and Opportunity keep on going. Many extended missions. They just did it again, I think, a month or so ago for another couple of years. So, I think they go every 6 months or a year. But they extend it all the time. And that saves a lot of money. You don't have to launch new spacecraft every time something is done like that. You might remember Deep Impact a couple of years ago went up to Temple 1 Comet, and from the mother craft, they launched this other craft that slammed into the comet, and they got all kinds of scientific reports back from that. But everybody wonders what happens to the mother craft. You know, it just floated off into space, the one that took all the pictures and everything. Well, they rename it, they create an extended mission with it, and that's what they did for Deep Impact. Now they call it the Epoxy mission, and they give this big long fancy name. You know, wrote it down here. Extra planet observation and characterization and Deep Impact extended investigation. It just they combine the two names. They make this big one. Name out of it and come out with the name Epoxy, but essentially it's the same spacecraft, the same mother craft that took all the pictures. Well, it's going to go off to another comet. They planned on one particular comet, and now they can't find it. They think a particular comet has disintegrated. Now they're looking for Plan B, is a comet called Hartley 2, and they're going to probably arrive at that maybe 600 miles away from it in the year 2010. But as far as saving money, everybody they'll knock NASA the left and right, but they do send these missions. They find out other purposes for it afterwards, which saves a lot of money in launching these things. So, I think it's a good idea. Another mission coming up at the end of January, Dick, is one you mentioned recently, which is the last mission, the Gamma Ray Large Area Space Telescope. Purpose is to take pictures of black holes and find out how this matter that is being accelerated out from the black hole at nearly the speed of light, what's going on there. They'll investigate that. One of the big things they'll be looking for also is gamma ray bursts. You have the Swift spacecraft doing the same thing, but essentially Swift finds it real quick, takes pictures of it, lets all the other observatories on Earth also notifies them, and they're able to take quick pictures of this thing. Sometimes they don't last that long. This one here, this is more powerful. It will take in-depth pictures of a lot of different wavelengths of each gamma ray burst. They expect to get a lot of scientific data from this. There's a lot of unknowns that you don't know about them, and they hope to discover that with that. They'll use the same spacecraft over to investigate dark matter for the first time. That problem out, find out what's going on with the dark matter, take pictures of areas where affected it is, and what gives there. It's not going to be that high. It's a low Earth orbit mission. It's 350 miles up, probably the same altitude as Hubble, and they don't want to go too high. It's the Van Allen belt. It'll foul up all their detectors. They have detectors, it's not really like a telescope. It's metal. They use tungsten, whatever. It hits the tungsten gamma ray bursts. They give off electrons, positrons, and all kinds of different values. Somehow they're able to measure it. Not your first telescope when you were a kid, that's for sure. That's pretty much all I got, I think. Back to NASA. This is WSTM.
What part of what Paul is talking about is that when it comes to a gamma ray telescope, it doesn't look like a telescope that you and I know about. You don't just set up a set of lenses along a tube and call it a telescope, because gamma rays will go roaring right through that lens and say, nothing is there. I'm not going to be focused by that. What you've got to do instead is to use a very heavy metal interrupter with holes in it in just the right position. Tungsten is the material they use. And with the hole pattern in this tungsten aperture, you're able to get a picture out of that, believe it or not, a very high-resolution picture. Turns out that comets are also being studied quite a bit, because there's a strong belief that the water that's on the Earth now got placed there by all the comets that crashed into the Earth after the early days of formation of the Earth. The Earth in the very beginning was very hot, didn't have the opportunity to have water on board. As it cooled down, eventually comets hitting us deposited water. And where does the water come from that's on the comet? That's another interesting question. Well, a comet that the astronomers, the amateur astronomers, have been studying a lot over the last couple of months is Comet 17P Holmes. 17 /HOLMES is the name of it. Holmes is the name of the guy who discovered the comet. 17P means that it's a periodic comet, and of the series of periodic comets, it was the 17th one discovered. I think Halley's comet was the first one. I think that's the 1P Halley, but I'm not sure about that. Okay, the 17P Holmes comet never got very close to the sun, but it did come closer to our area of the solar system. As it did, it got heated by the sun and started puffing out a whole lot of material. Okay, this comet became a puffy ball of material. It didn't have a clearly defined tail to it like an ordinary comet. It just puffed out material in all different directions. Okay, they were, in the beginning when it first started puffing up, it was a very bright object that you could see with the naked eye on a dark area. With binoculars, it looked even better. And as they watched it from day to day and week to week, starting back in October, this thing became a bigger and bigger puffy ball. The next question is, how big a puffy ball did it make? And the answer, it is now larger than the diameter of the sun. That's one hell of a comet. It got dimmer and dimmer as it did that. It became a great big puffy ball, larger in diameter than the moon, larger in diameter than the sun. First of all, from our point of view, and second of all, in real diameter, it became larger than the sun. Unusual comet. So you think you've seen it all, you haven't seen nothing yet. Just wait, we put up this super sensitive gamma ray telescope, and we really, with high resolution, start looking at gamma rays for the first. You're looking at the whole universe with a gamma ray camera, as opposed to the previous cameras. Guarantee we're going to see things that are going to be a surprise. Okay, I thank you for all that information now, Paul. Keep up the good work. And by the way, I'm making some further guesses with reference to those hydrogen sensors that grounded the space shuttle. Four sensors have to be in the hydrogen tank. Three of them have to be operating in order to make a valid launch, and they're down the two that are operating. And I think it's indicating of the level of the hydrogen fuel in the tank. If during a blast off, the fuel in the hydrogen tank should run out, and you have the rocket engine still running, my first speculation was that you would rat race that turbine that's pressurizing the hydrogen, liquid hydrogen, through that 19-inch, 17-inch diameter piece of tubing that goes from the tank to the shuttle. Second of all, the hydrogen fuel, I believe, is one of the substances that's directed through that tubing on the outside of the rocket engine itself, and it does the cooling. And if you suddenly lose cooling, you're going to melt down an engine. Now, I think that engine is only used during the ascent to orbit. I think once you get in orbit, all of your maneuvering and re-entry burn is done by the orbital maneuvering engines, a different set of engines. So still, you don't want to burn up that engine, so therefore, they want to make sure they've got a good sense that they don't want to fail the turbine and have the shrapnel going all over the place, which could be life-threatening, and they don't want to overheat the main rocket engine, which could melt it down and be an extremely expensive repair. I think this is the nature of the possible damage that occurs, that could occur, if you run out of hydrogen fuel and you don't properly sense it with those fuel gauge sensors. Is that approximately the way you see it, Paul? WS2N, T2RIW?
Oh, yeah, you have it right. Very good, Dick. And the main hydrogen line is one of the ones that disconnect, and the oxygen line, you see that one running down the outside of the external tanks in the top, and they have the two big doors in the back that close after the connections are disconnected. So when the external tank is gone, that's it. No more fuel for those three big engines. When you see the liftoff, you'll see the solid booster rockets go, of course, the one that's on the port and soft side of the craft. And you always, they always show a close-up view, and you can see the three main rockets firing on the shuttle. So, that balances exactly with the solid boosters. And this way, if you didn't have that, you'd have a separation of where the connections are on the from the orbiter to the tank. And then, of course, when you get high enough and you have this two minutes plus a few seconds, the solid boosters disconnect. Those three main engines continue flying the orbiter and the external tank to orbit to MECO, main engine cutoff. And the main tank disconnects, and that's it. That's it for those three main engines. If you look at the back of the shell, you'll see the three main engines, and then up near the top, you'll see two engines sticking out. They're not fired during the liftoff, but the OMS engines are fired for orbital maneuvering engines. If you get halfway around the Earth, they'll fire again to to circularize the orbit, and then they'll fire them one more time when they want to deorbit to return to Earth. They'll face the shuttle backwards, fire the OMS rockets, the orbital maneuvering engines, and that's how they come back. So, yeah, you're right, Dick. And the cooling lines for the really what they are for the shrouds on the main engine rockets are from the hydrogen lines, and of course they're not needed anymore after after Miko. So that's it, and it's amazing that we've only got a couple more years to think about this, and all this information that we passed along here on the net will be history to some degree, because we'll be into a new rocket altogether, the Constellation series with Orion and the spacecraft and the Ares five rocket that will be launching these things, and how they're designed and what technology they've taken from the Saturn missions, Saturn V missions, and what technology that they're going to be utilizing from the shuttle missions, including the external tanks, how they're going to be utilized, and how the solid booster rockets will be utilized, and yes, how the main engines we're talking about on the shuttle will also be utilized in the future Constellation Mission 6. So it's going to be interesting after 2010. Back to you, WS.
We live in an exciting time. And from all you can tell, the Space Transport System, number 125, STS-125, Hubble repair mission, which I think is late in 2008. Is that one still on schedule, to your knowledge, Paul?
I haven't looked it up in the last, oh, I'd say 3 weeks, 4 weeks, but yeah, as of a month ago, and I'm sure I would have heard something if they were going to cancel that for any reason. Big news if they do that thing.
Okay, so we keep our fingers crossed, and Hubble is going to be repaired, and I'm a Hubble hugger. We haven't got a replacement for Hubble for some time to come, and when we finally do, it's going to be another big. Mel, what have you seen in your mailbag lately? And have you found any goodies there? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, very good, Paul. See, very interesting. I was always curious, when a comet has that tail flying away from it, leading it, or whatever you want to call it, that material that's coming off the comet is being dispersed, I assume, into space. What renews it? I mean, why didn't Halley's Comet, run out of material, Dick, over?
My understanding is that a comet, the average comet, is multiple miles in diameter. Whole lot of stuff. But it's a low-density, flaky stuff interspersed with ice and things like that. So each time a comet comes near the sun and the surface becomes heated, some of that surface boils off. And when the surface boils off, you're getting ice going from the solid state to the gaseous state as a vapor. It's carrying particles of dust with it. And so you get this light, fluffy stuff coming off the comet. And the solar wind coming out of the sun pushes against those materials, pushes them all backwards in one direction, and you end up with a comet tail. What's unique about this comet 17 Papa Holmes is that it is not pushing out the material gently from a couple of fissures somewhere in the surface that are being heated, but apparently has a zillion little holes all over the place around the perimeter of this comet, and it's all shooting out material in all various directions, and it apparently is shooting out rather heavy material, which is not easily being pushed around by the solar wind. The solar wind really means that there's a bunch of particles boiling off the sun coming out into space at a million miles an hour. And when some of those particles hit the northern extremity of the Earth, we call it aurora borealis. or when it hits the southern pole, we call it aurora australis. But that's the solar wind that you're seeing hitting the atmosphere and glowing. That's what the aurora is. But those solar wind particles, when they hit the light, fluffy stuff out of the comet, push it backwards into a tail. And in the case of that Holmes comet, the material is coming out with such high velocity from multiple locations in multiple directions that it formed a great big fluffy ball around the comet. And that fluffy ball got as large in diameter as the sun. Unusual comet. Back to you, Mel.
Roger, thanks for all the years that Halley's comet's been coming visiting all the time, that been running out of material to eject. So how large is Halley's comet, being that most famous object, you think, number one? How large is its actual size with the comet being sent over?
And a comet XWS 20.
Go ahead, Paul. Maybe you know. How big is Halley or any of these other comets? Go ahead, Paul.
Halley, I forgot. I don't want to say, I think it was, less than a mile. No. But, we could find that one on the internet probably real quick, but, 8/10 of a mile rings a bell. But I might be off on that. No, I wanted to make a comment that I know Dick knows, and a lot of people don't realize this, maybe some younger people that are curious about the comets, when they see that tail, they look at that and the books are actually in the sky, and they'll think, well, it's going in that direction, you know, it has nothing to do with that. The comet could actually be going in a completely different trajectory, completely different way in the direction that tail is going. All that tail is being created by the particles leaving the sun, pushing out. So actually, that's the opposite direction. How do I put it now, Dick? It's the flow of the flow of electrons or protons, whatever's coming out of the sun. But actually, both all the ionized particles and everything coming out of the sun that's hitting the comet. It's actually going in line from the sun, away from the sun. But it's not the direction of the comet. I don't think I didn't put that right. I think you probably explained that better. The tail itself, the direction coming from the comet is not. It's a optical illusion, actually. Back to you, Dick.
No, I agree with you, Paul. Almost all comets have a highly elliptical orbit, but it doesn't have to be that way. In theory, you could have a comet that has a circular orbit midway between the orbit of the Earth and the orbit of Mars, for instance. Now that comet is always moving in a circular orbit at right angles to the direction of the sun. But that comet would have a tail that's always directed away from the sun, the anti-solar direction. So therefore the tail would be at right angles to the direction the comet is moving. Some people think that the tail coming out of the comet is like a jet engine. Not at all. The comet can move in any direction it wants to. The tail will always be in the direction away from the sun, because that's where the solar wind is coming from that streams past the comet and pushes the tail in that direction. With the exception of Comet 17 Papa Holmes. His tail refuses to respond to the solar wind. I think many of these comets are at least a mile in diameter, Mel. A lot of material. Each time it goes near the sun, it boils off a couple of inches of material. And when you've got a mile diameter, you've got 10 square miles of surface area. And you boil off 1 inch of that material, I'm just making numbers up here, that's a lot of material you're burning off, but percentage-wise, you're burning off very little of the comet. And because this material is being lit up by the sun's light and it glows against the dark sky, it's a very low-density thing you're looking at when you look at that comet. you think there's a lot of material there. It's really like the smoke coming out of a cigarette. Not very much material, but if you shine a bright enough light onto the smoke coming out of a cigarette, you could be led to believe when you look at that from 10 feet away that something very massive is coming out of a cigarette. In reality, it's something very low in mass. K2KEY and K2RIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. I sort of answered this way. It's all around. Most likely it started out at some eons ago on much bigger pieces of material. And I guess that question still is, where did it get the ions from? I don't know if we'll answer that. So why do comets have this ice content? Is it the only how would you describe a comet? Is it a type of meteor, type of device, or whatever? Is it the only thing that comes flying around that has ice? Let's put it that way. Is it the only ice body that floats around and you start to think over?
Okay. I don't think so. You got objects coming in from the Oort cloud, from the Kuiper belt. These are great big clouds that are way out beyond our solar system around the sun. Some of those objects are very large and don't have a tail to them. We tend to call them asteroids, although the asteroids tend to be close in orbits. The comets are the ones that have the highly elliptical orbits, usually going from close to the sun to way out beyond Pluto, many of the comets. And the comets seem to be the ones that have the ice. The asteroids do not. However, we've now flown by missions to both asteroids and comets, and in both cases, you see a whole lot of pockmarks where meteorites have, I'm going to call them meteorites, have hit these spatial objects. There are things hitting the asteroids. There are things hitting the comets all the time. So is the comet always decreasing in size? Not necessarily. If he's got a particular trajectory where a lot of things hit him, he could be gaining in mass, not losing. So it ain't clear. And some of them, when you get a close-up picture, they've got a very funny, fluffy surface texture that looks like a whole bunch of cliffs to them. One of those asteroids with a close-up picture looks like it's got a whole lot of natural cliffs that were probably caused by impacts and great big craters. And when you got a very low gravity object, a crater due to an impact takes on a very different appearance. So what makes comets and asteroids so interesting is they are undisturbed natural objects that have been in the solar system for millions and billions of years. So by sampling their material, you're sampling past history of this solar system, and maybe you can go back millions and billions of years and know something about what the whole system used to look like, chemistry-wise, how it used to behave. I mean, as you take an ice core from the Antarctic region of the world and you study those bubbles of oxygen that are in the ice bubbles, and you measure the oxygen-16, oxygen-18 isotope ratio, you can figure out to a very small fraction of a degree what was the average temperature of the Earth during that period of time when that ice was laid down. And you can lay down, you can look at those ice cores and look at the temperature profiles of the Earth way back hundreds of thousands of years. And you'll see that we've gone through ice age and thermal cycles many times. And the particular thermal cycle we're going through right now doesn't look very different than the previous one. So the global warming we're now worrying about, is it a natural phenomenon or are we accelerating it with our hydrocarbon burning techniques? Ain't super clear. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Yeah, there was a discussion on where one of the scientists said that the so-called global warming is because we're still coming out of the last ice age, that we're still warming up from the last ice age, which was about 15, 20,000 years ago. And this, we're still haven't completely, in other words, come out of that ice period of ice, that what we're still experiencing, the warming after the last ice age. Whether or not that's true or not, possibly, like you say, from those cores that they dig up there, maybe they can see these different cycles. All right, anyhow, shall we get back, I guess, to ham radio, Dick, over.
Yeah, do you have any interesting ones in the mailbag?
Okay, yeah, I'm pulling out some, looking. Let's see, let me look at some here. Oh, here's a thank you. Last week you told me how to modify my headphones. Oh, yes, remember the gentleman that has says that he's getting on in age and having a little trouble understanding DW because the headphones says right to. I once told somebody how to go about adding a little network onto the headphones, a toroid, and you know, and experiment with some capacitors with that past decade, and sort of tailor-make the headphones to work for your ears. And he says, oh, he says it worked like magic. Now, thank you very, very much. We appreciate you and Dick and everybody else on the TechNet that every week brings us so much useful information. I am a faithful listener. How you like that one, Dick?
Fantastic. We want to send that guy one of those prizes that we send out periodically, Mel, a ticket for a nice free dinner in New York City, him and his lady friend. Put him on the list, Mel.
All right. Let's look at some more. Let's see. Ah, recently I went to a hamvention, and I saw something that the guy was selling very reasonable, very interesting gadget. Said it was a Gunplex. Oh, yes, Gunplex, the transceiver. Gee, still some around. And he said the only thing that's missing from it, gee, is this correct? A Fresnel zone plate. Oh, boy. For 10.4 gigs. Do you know anything about this? Oh, well, I'll turn it over to you. You're the expert, Dick.
Yeah, I have used Gunplexers. And most Gunplexers work very nicely with a simple horn. And if you go to W1 Gigahertz, W1 Golf Hotel Zulu, his website, and he's got an online book, online microwave book. He has a very simple technique for bending up a tin, sheet metal, or pieces of copper-clad board to make the horn that goes on the front of that Gunplexer. Very easy to build a horn. A few guys have experimented with a Fresnel zone plate instead of a horn as a way of focusing the energy comes out of there. That's a tough way to go. It's an interesting experiment. I do not recommend it. You get a lot more bang for your dollar by building a horn and putting the horn in front of that gun flexor if it doesn't already have one. When it comes to doing QSOs, gunplexer, it's a fun project, and there's a number of websites that will tell you how to do that. You don't get as much range out of a so-called narrowband technique using single sideband on 10 gigs, which I've done more of than I have with gunplexers. The gunplexer allows you to get on 10 gigs in a weekend, so to speak, very easily, but you don't get as much range out of it, and you almost always use FM modulation with a gunplexer. Whereas a real single sideband rig, amplitude modulated, gives you a lot more receiver threshold and a lot more range. So, if he's got a gunplexer with no horn on the front, building the horn is easy. Buying the horn is easy. If he already has a horn there, use it as is. Consider building a bigger horn if you want more gain, but I wouldn't recommend going over to the Fresnel zone plate. But you can read about the Fresnel zone plate on two locations. The W1 Gigahertz online book, and also Tom Williams, WA1MBA, WA1MBA.org. You also read about gunplexers on that website and his brief history of microwave ham radio. So there's lots of references on how to make proper use of a gunplexer, a fun toy. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey. You're saying to me that there was such a thing as a Fresnel phone plate. What it do is, what it actually